Hello, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you from UBC's Vancouver campus, located on and around the ancestral unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. This is a very special Access Day interview with some of the team from Steps Forward, a post-secondary access-oriented organisation that operates on a number of campuses around BC. This interview features Ben Ross, who works at SFU, Selina Maher and Ellie Kellel, who both work at UBC Vancouver, and Tyra Golob, who works at UVic. Enjoy.
We are here for Access Day, which is a day all about talking about people with access needs and what that looks like in life and how you access those kinds of resources and all those questions. So I suppose the first kind of thing to talk about really is what Steps Forward is in simple terms that everyone will understand. Would someone like to tell us what Steps Forward is?
Yeah, I can share a little bit about what Steps Forward is. So Steps Forward is a provincial nonprofit that establishes inclusive post-secondary initiatives with universities across BC. The way that students enroll in their courses and programs varies from campus to campus, but the goal for each is the same. It's that students are fully included in their undergraduate program of study. That could mean following an academic program plan, taking the courses typical of any student in their program, and fully participating in all aspects of courses like practicums, co-op, work placements. Facilitators often are working behind the scenes to bring in departments, course instructors, and staff who make that enrollment happen. And that means that students are not taking part in any separate experiences on campus. They're fully included in the program that they decide to study. Collaborating like this is really emphasizing it's a partnership between inclusive post-secondary and institutions like UVic or UBC or SFU.
Cool. And how did you guys kind of come to be involved with STEPS?
I think that's a great question, and I don't want to speak for everyone here, but I think we all have pretty different backgrounds, and that is maybe part of the appeal. I think what Steps Forward is trying to do is shift a little bit away from the traditional human services model. So, you know, certainly a lot of really well-intentioned work happening there and people in that line of work. But I think the intention maybe for Steps Forward is to have folks from kind of all walks of life, maybe not specifically with like disability training having studied some of those specifics, but maybe kind of coming at this with a different approach and prioritizing finding people who are interested in getting to know students for who they are and their interests and doing our best to empower a student to, you know, make choices through their university journeys.
So you said in there about moving away from, what was the phrase you used?
I used traditional human services model.
Okay. And what does that mean, or whatever word you choose to use? What are you kind of referring to there?
What I'd be referring to is sort of the traditional approach sort of happening in BC and Canada. I'm certainly not an expert, so also take that with a grain of salt. But maybe since deinstitutionalization has happened for supporting adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, a lot of the supports have looked like segregated services and programming. So maybe sort of more focused on finding ways to occupy the time for people with disabilities day in and day out. It's very activity-based, programmatic-based, and very, very notably not necessarily being part of the wider community, not always centering the interests and aspirations of an individual who, you know, may be interested in some of the activities that are being programmed for them, but without that choice, probably would want to do a lot of other things, probably have goals that are aligned more towards anything else anyone else wants to do, having a job, career, meaningful hobbies, meaningful relationships, etc.
So, Selina, tell me a bit about how you came to be involved with STEPS.
I've been working here on campus for almost 2 years now. Before that, I had a very different background from everyone. I think just like Ben said, like we all come from different parts of life and everything and study very different stuff. I think ultimately we all want to do something to, you know, support people, advocate and all that. I actually studied sociology and psych, and then I was a tattoo apprentice for a while, and then I decided I just wanted to do something else, and
here you are.
Yeah, here I am.
How about you, Ellie?
So I studied at UBC. I studied psychology. I just graduated last year. So
congratulations.
Thank you. I was drawn to Steps Forward. I wanted to do something not in an office, not a standard, typical 9-to-5, but I was drawn to Steps Forward because of the way that they – let me think about how I want to word this. I like that it's a pathway rather than a program, and it offers students a pathway to attend university instead of just placing them in a program, and I really liked that method.
I think that's a really nice point to kind of come onto the bulk of the conversation, which is, you know, what does Steps Forward do on a kind of day-to-day basis? And when we were sending a few emails beforehand and kind of talking about what we were going to talk about, one of the points that was highlighted was Steps Forward is a pathway, not a program. Can someone sort of elaborate on what that means to you guys or to Steps Forward? What does that kind of difference mean? And what does Steps Forward look like on sort of a day-to-day basis for you guys in, you know, individually? What are you doing when you say it's not kind of a traditional 9-to-5? What does it look like?
We really try to emphasize that the work that we do on campus is not a program. The students that we work for are not our students. They are UBC students. They are SFU students. They are UVic students. Whatever the campus is, they are. We really want to emphasize that's their student identity. Many times there's that sort of, I think, stereotype that, or I guess not even just stereotype, but assumption that people with disabilities are always in a program or they're always part of like a specialized thing for specifically them. And so our work here is to kind of change that narrative and also advocate over the fact that like inclusion is like everyone's job, kind of, you know, like it's not very linear. There's not one specific way to do inclusion. It looks very different for different people. The way I think obviously with Steps Forward is this partnership that we have with the university is very different from what a typical the stereotypical way that people with disabilities go for. And so we want to support them in that sort of pathway. Students are not they're expected and engage and are involved in classes just the way, like the same way as everybody else. There's not sort of a special treatment there, but we do support them on the side. So with like modifications, if there's any assignments, that's kind of our role. There's a lot of different parts of our role, but it's just like, yeah, modification is a big part of it because everybody learns very differently.
So does a student come to Steps Forward before they're enrolled in university, or is it once they get to university it then sort of it appears, or what's the kind of the process for students becoming involved with Steps Forward?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, essentially the application process does happen through Steps Forward, and it's students who have identified that they are wanting to go to post-secondary, and that maybe the traditional means of applying might not be available to them. They may not have the credentials to get into post-secondary institutions in the traditional pathway. So through Steps Forward, students apply. We have essentially very few requirements and none related to behavior or academic prerequisites. Our only requirements are that students are eligible for CLBC funding, which is kind of a whole like rabbit hole we can get into or not, and that they're over 19 years or older. And what we're really looking for, unlike maybe a traditional application process that would look at grades, credentials, references, we're more interested in seeing and meeting students who see university as something that fits with their goals. They may not know, like any young person may not know what exactly they're going to study, but they know they want to go to university, they want to advance through a program of study, and sort of ultimately they want to, you know, set the table for career opportunities after that, like any reason that anyone goes to university, right? And maybe in the meantime as well, connecting with people on campus, communities on campus, making friends, joining clubs, and sort of setting that table for lifelong inclusion.
So how many students are kind of involved in Steps Forward at the moment?
It depends on each campus. Depending on how many inclusion facilitators there are. At UBC, there's just the two of us. And then, I don't know, SFU,
There's three full-time inclusion facilitators. So we have capacity to support 9 students on campus.
So each facilitator can work with up to 3 students?
Right, that's math kind of works that way.
Essentially.
If you're full-time... facilitator, it sort of equates to supporting 3 students.
And how many post-secondary institutions are involved in Steps Forward?
11 now. So as of last year, where we partnered with College of New Caledonia in Prince George, that was our 11th partnership across the province. With the first starting with the initiative starting in 2001 and students enrolling first at Emily Carr in 2002 and at UBC in 2003. So in the last 20 plus years, growing to 11 partnerships across the province.
So how did Steps Forward come to exist?
Kind of like what we've been talking about, like Ben mentioned. So Steps Forward kind of first started back in 2001 with parents and families kind of asking this question of like, you know, what can I do more to support my child, my son and daughter, to lead a life full of inclusion. And so that's kind of where everything kind of came about. So families advocating for inclusion on post-secondary education. So inclusive post-secondary education exists just to ensure that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities are fully included as students in the academic and social life of colleges and university across British Columbia. And yeah, there was very, very few options that existed back then. A lot of it were those segregated programs. A lot of it were not offered in a university setting or college setting.
When you say a segregated program, what does that mean?
Yeah, so that would mean like disability-focused day programs, a lot of institutions, I guess.
That were kind of designed to cater specifically for students with access needs?
Catering specifically for folks with developmental and intellectual disabilities, and that sort of emphasis on more like activity program-based ways to fill your day. Different places obviously do different things, and there's a range of experience for folks, like there is in everything. But what's often like maybe kind of drawn out as like the classic example of a segregated day program would be, you know, every Wednesday, you and the 6 people in your day program go bowling, and on Thursdays there's a coloring activity. It's very much like kind of passive activities, ways to spend time, but very much not ways to be like building meaningful relationships outside of the segregated space, and sort of working towards like being able to access what everybody else is interested in. We use the phrase like the good things in life, which is like kind of cheesy, but to sort of illustrate like what most people want in life, certainly not everyone, but what most people are looking for in life, maybe being the ability to build deep and meaningful relationships, have fulfilling work, hobbies, and activities, the ability to have a say in where you live and with whom. Pretty basic things that if you ask most people, you probably aren't thinking about all the time. But if you were to analyze like, oh, what am I doing or what am I working towards? It's kind of those sorts of things. What do I have access to? It's those sorts of things that historically and still very much like today, people with developmental and intellectual disabilities just do not have access to.
So is Steps Forward primarily for students with developmental and intellectual. Is disability the right word there?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, for sure.
Okay. And then is it about the academic side of things? Obviously, you're talking a lot here about kind of like filling your time and the things you do when you're not in class. Is there an academic aspect to Steps Forward as well? Or is it very much about kind of the social aspect? Or is it sort of a combination of the two?
It's a combination of both. So we're really working towards providing students with the most authentic student experience. So it is clubs and events as well as support that they may need in class. And that's where we're able to modify work. I think Selena mentioned a little bit earlier about modifications, but that's something we can do to work with the students to get to know their learning style and adjust assignments that way while keeping the integrity of the original assignment. For example, I've supported students who were able to demonstrate their learning through visual projects instead of written essays and final tests. So sometimes that looked like creating, you know, a visual poster board instead of a written essay, or making a video with visual effects and edits instead of a final essay. But we're really able to work with each student individually and provide individual support just to suit their learning needs and their learning styles. And that's a really nice thing about our work. But sometimes it also looks like the social aspect. So going to events, I'll be supporting a student later at a volunteer opportunity later tonight. I supported students with lots of different events this term at UBC, and lots of different kinds of events too, cooking events and de-stressing events and lots of different things. So that's kind of why our role is not very typical and can look different from day to day.
So how does a student, once they're involved with Steps Forward, before they find a place at university, how do they kind of look at selecting a university, and how do you kind of work out what a student would benefit from?
I guess the process for students who are interested in attending post-secondary it's different for everybody. It depends on if they have a clear direction of what they want to study. There are some students who their focus really is on having that authentic campus life experience. They're coming to university to do the typical things like making friends, joining clubs, and really finding their people there. I think that we talk a lot about the academic and employment side of things, but I think campus life is really what a lot of people are looking to engage in. There was like a story that I wanted to share about students having a typical campus experience. Could be anything from like a work study job on campus, joining an advocacy group, or attending the events that students look forward to that happen every year. Mm-hmm. I know a student who really loves live music. She loves going to the pub. She also works at the Gender Empowerment Center. She's made friends there who also love music. Something that I did as a facilitator was sort of sharing things that are going on campus with her and her mm-hmm. friends that align with that. So there's Battle of the Bands that happens every year, and they all really wanted to go. The student that I have in mind uses PECS, or Picture Exchange Communication System, when she's connecting with others. It's you pair words and pictures together, and then they build a sentence on, say, she uses an iPad. Something that I did to help facilitate her asking her friends was adding the words like Battle of the Bands, adding in her friends' names to that system, and the question of like, let's go, so that she could invite them. And yeah, they ended up going and having a great time. And on their own together, they made a plan to go to the finale at the end of the semester. I think that like having the tools for other people to have the tools to like make that invite and do it on their own, that was really meaningful. And it all came about by like a student having an opportunity to work on campus and then make friends on campus and then, you know, invite those friends and then have them invite her to attend events as well.
So did that student or students generally, I suppose, do you find that they kind of come with ideas of things they might be interested in? Or is it kind of a bit more of like, here are some things that you might be interested in? How does that kind of conversation happen?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of both. We usually meet with students weekly on campus to talk about everything going on campus, how classes are going. A lot of times we're spending getting to know students, then we can sort of find these things that are happening and share those. But also a lot of times students do come to us with things and saying like, I would really like to attend this and I'd really like to invite someone. Can you help me? And that's like totally our role as a facilitator is to say, yeah, let's go. Let's figure out how we can do this together.
Do you guys find that generally speaking, most things can be achieved? Does a student ever come to you and say, can we do this? And you're like, actually, I just don't know how we make that happen. Or is there always a solution?
I think that it's hard to say that there is always a solution, mm-hmm. but I think that we totally want there to be a solution, mm-hmm. and always want to sort of figure out how that can be done. Mm-hmm. With our focus being, like Tyra was saying, getting to know a student really well, learning what they're interested in doing. If they are not sure what they're interested in doing, doing the work of like presenting different ideas, right? Like if they've maybe hinted mm-hmm. at some like passing interest in, I don't know, mountain biking or something, like, okay, like is there community on campus or off campus that is really mm-hmm. into mountain biking that we could connect with, that maybe we could even sort of support this community to invite this person in, and maybe that's something that would be helpful for someone to be like, oh yeah, I actually do, like, it's not a passing interest, like I was mm-hmm. just sort of waiting for the opportunity to arise or for that invite to come. That's often what our work can look like.
So are you guys constantly picking up new skills and suddenly discovering your own passions in mountain
yeah.
biking?
Yeah.
Sometimes. You get to try lots of new things.
Mm-hmm. Most of our work is like kind of behind the scenes or mm-hmm. on the side, just so, you know, we're not really seen as like a support worker or sometimes there's been actually students like classmates or people who would talk to us directly instead of the students. So honestly, most of our work happens behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. I know like I've supported a student, an acting student, and not unfortunately, but I was his acting partner, which I am not an actor. But, you know, those are moments where I see as like a facilitator, like, okay, what would a typical student do in this scenario? What are ways that I can support the student to connect with other acting students to act with him instead of just me, you know? So, yeah, a lot of our work does happen behind the scenes. I unfortunately did not pick up on acting, but yeah.
What a part of our role, too, is you know, it really varies. I think that's going to be a common theme in this discussion. But like when we know a student is interested in something, but they're unsure of what that, like how to take an interest and take it to the next level, or if it's a potential employment opportunity, anything in their academic journey, whatever it is, like oftentimes, maybe what at least has been kind of surprising to me in this role and difficult, but makes a lot of sense and is informed by some thoughtful consideration, is that in our role, we may have to put ourselves in like positions we're uncomfortable in, mm-hmm. approaching all kinds of different people, like mm-hmm. in a sort of like cold way, like cold call kind of way, with maybe asks or we put ourselves out there, which is difficult to do for anybody. What we try with that approach, or what we're thinking about with that approach, is that oftentimes for people with developmental and intellectual disabilities, the sort of like the amount of rejection that folks have faced in mm-hmm. all kinds of settings, social settings, community school settings, whatever it is, it's just way higher than other folks would be. So even though it's difficult in our role to maybe like have to face that rejection from an employer or like an awkward conversation with someone, it's really thinking like, okay, like we need to work to make sure that the folks that we're working for are not just like kind of constantly facing a barrage of rejection, which has unfortunately like been commonplace for a lot of folks.
You talk about, you know, students with these access needs coming up against a lot of rejection themselves. How do you think we as a society, be that on a the university campus or a broader society or an interest group, how do we kind of change those perceptions?
Thinking about our approach, the word inclusion is really a broad word, and we've noticed a lot for sure is being used more and more to the point where it's kind of lost its meaning. But if we're thinking about like real inclusion versus a segregated approach, that's a world of difference.
Yeah, the work that we do facilitating inclusion, just in general, the movement of inclusion is very countercultural. It's not, very typical, and so raising awareness is one thing, but like you said, like the systematic approach of things is also like another conversation. Sometimes it's honestly just thinking like, what would another student do? Or can I approach and make the ask for, a club or an event in a way that's more, approachable compared to, or even asking them to make the ask to the student.
So going to the club and saying, I have a friend who is, I know might be interested in judo.
But they
don't know how to reach out.
And a lot of people, I think what I was trying to get at too, is a lot of people, because of the segregated system that exists in BC and Canada, for folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities, a lot of people like just simply don't know how to act, how to invite someone in that they maybe are recognizing as potentially having a disability label. They may be open to it, but they're not sure. Because of this segregated system, oftentimes maybe students with developmental and intellectual disabilities are grouped in a cohort, or they're always accompanied by a support person. Mm-hmm. That has really created a perception that I think for a lot of other folks in society that they're taken care of, kind of, mm-hmm. and that, what's the inclusion that needs to happen? Like, they've got a group, they've mm-hmm. got a support person with mm-hmm. them. Why make that ask? And that's something that we're really intentional about. So kind of going a little bit off topic, but thinking about like the classroom, obviously a huge area of university. We've talked a lot about campus life for sure, but people are primarily going to class day in and day out. Mm-hmm. As best we can, there are definitely instances where it may be necessary for us to be in the classroom, but most of the time we would really try to not go to the class with a student and accompany them. And that's just with that simple thought that like if anyone else in that class kind of notices that and sees that this one student's always is with a support worker, I think it just takes off the table the idea that this person can potentially be their friend, because they think, well, they've got this support person, like, mm-hmm. it might be awkward to approach them, or like, I shouldn't, or like, I don't know, maybe there's a rule against it, whatever it is. So really trying to be thoughtful about that kind of perception building.
Just to add to that too, like our support is not only for students that we work for, it's also for the community, instructors, employers, coordinators, whatever, because like Ben had mentioned, like a lot of these people are not very familiar or have these sort of assumptions. There's that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities have, and so our job here is to kind of just support them also in realizing like, hey, these are the tools that I know works really well for this student, or hey, I know this student would really appreciate you reaching out to them instead of me.
You can ask this person to hang out. You don't need to go through us, like, if you have questions, you can ask us, but you can engage another person like you might anyone else.
There's this one time, like even a student, like an instructor had approached me and she was like, oh, I know the student's graduating. Do you think she would really appreciate if I'd done this? And I was like, oh, okay. Like even something as simple like that, we are always here to kind of answer those questions, and even providing her those sort of reflections or like reflective thoughts of like, well, would you do this for any other student? And she kind of took a step back and she was like, oh, actually, I wouldn't actually do this for every other student. But it's kind of like those assumptions that society has for people that we work for. So,
yeah. And just back to the conversation about people who are a little bit on the fence about if they want to, include a student in the class or the event or whatever it may be. we've met a lot of really great allies on campus and people who have success stories and who have really positive things to say. And it always helps to hear and kind of name drop a little bit some other people who have included students in their classes and stuff that they can go to. Just hearing it from other faculty sometimes helps. So that's really great to have those allies on campus, and we can refer to them.
I think there was something interesting you said there, Selena, about the example you gave about the teacher who kind of came to you and said, oh, would this be a good thing or not? And then you said they took a step back and thought, actually, I wouldn't do that for other students. So how do you find that balance between trying to support someone without kind of over, you know, infantilizing them or making them feel like they are lesser? How do you kind of approach that as someone who wants to support, you know, people they come across?
Something that we've noticed that has been really helpful in the past has just been when peers in class that don't have disabilities, when they include the students in their classes with disabilities and have the same expectations for them that they would for any other students, it sends a message that the inclusion is not an optional thing, it's just expected, and it helps to for the peers to demonstrate inclusion and see what it actually looks like in action, and shift the mindset and embed inclusion as the norm. So holding expectations for students has been really helpful, and expecting their participation in group projects and stuff. I think sometimes students without disabilities can sometimes allocate certain tasks that for students with disabilities that kind of limit them. So just fully including them in the project and expecting them to participate has been really helpful.
Okay. Holding, like, yeah, encouraging peers and professors to hold high expectations for the students that we're working for in their class. But at the same time, too, like, kind of like this line you're talking about, being mindful of sort of the, I don't know, I feel like the trope of, like, the exceptional person with a disability who is, like, above, against all odds, like, made it, and, like, yeah, the spotlight's on them, and, like, wow, even the fact that they're in class is, like, an achievement. Really being aware of that and trying to, like, yeah, as best we can, like, not sort of boost that trope. So I feel like that looks like, just like for anyone else in university, like, obviously we want the students we work for to have an exceptional experience in the sense that, like, they feel, like, so engaged in all their classes, they're involved in 100 clubs, they have, like, all these opportunities lined up. We want that, but also recognizing, too, that, like, university is an experience that has many ups and downs. A class can be really boring sometimes, and that's okay. And, like, a student that we work for can go skip class if they're not feeling it. Maybe, like, we would love for, like, that student to be skipping class because they want to see a friend on campus or something, but whatever it is, like recognizing that that's okay, too, and supporting the student to feel that, but then again, too, like, the university community to know that, and to know that, like, a student that they're potentially including in their class doesn't need to be the shining star. Can receive feedback. Can just like anybody else, like, experience a range of different emotions and experiences in class and outside of class.
Not to put Tyra on the spot, but, like, she has a really great story that, like, I really love, that talks about, like, this idea of peers and friends coming together, and advocating for a student that we work for. I don't know if you want to share that, Tyra, but right now, but I love that story.
Yeah, I'd love to share it. So when I'm sort of thinking of the role that peers and mentors and allies on campus have for inclusion, there's a story that comes to my mind that my coordinator had told me at the UVic campus. There was a time where students who were studying through inclusive post-secondary couldn't take part in graduation ceremonies and they couldn't walk on the stage with their peers. But in 2017, a UVic student studying political science and social justice was set to graduate, and this student mentioned to his friend that he would not be walking on stage with them. The friend thought that was really unfair, and they ended up circulating a petition that gained over 3,000 signatures from faculty and from other students. They also had an article on Czech News as well. And yeah, I think the connections that the student had made on campus really were the catalyst for the UVic Senate approving a change in policy for both him and students in the future. That graduation, he walked the stage with his fellow peers in that faculty and his friend who had helped push the movement forward. And I think that it really highlights how much more impactful inclusion on campus can be when it's driven by peers and mentors rather than solely by inclusion facilitators. Mm-hmm. I think the main thing that the institution of the university was more receptive to was that they were listening to their faculty and other students. And I think that really like made a huge difference as to who it was coming from to make that change.
I might be making an assumption here. Well, I am making an assumption. Whether it's accurate or not is another matter. But that strike the fact that, you know, those students in that instance weren't allowed to walk the stage, for example, strikes me as sort of just an outdated policy. I wonder, is a lot of what you guys are having to deal with kind of just outdated policy? And do you find that perhaps society's moving forward in terms of the way we think about things, but is the kind of legal infrastructure, the bureaucracy, is that catching up? Or, you know, are you constantly coming up against these things that just feel like, why is that totally the way it is? How long has it been like that?
Yeah, it's a lot of that. And especially on something like graduation or convocation, which is, you know, the university, like, ivory tower, you know, kind of quote unquote, like, it's steeped in a lot of traditions that a lot of folks hold and take very, very seriously. And, you know, I think to their credit, in you know, a lot of ways, they're like interesting traditions and fair enough. But that has led to maybe some resistance or just a slower pace of change for students being included in something like that. I think the example Tyra gave too is so good because it's student and faculty led movement to you know, kind of create this meaningful opportunity for the student to walk the stage, but not with any special designation, right? Like, mm-hmm. And that's kind of what we're saying, like, just to be one of their peers amongst the student body who graduated that day, you know, not walking with a big spotlight on them, like, but just to sort of like be able to be at the same level and have the same experience that their peers had.
Kind of like you were talking about in class, like they don't have to be the student, they don't have to be this, they're just a student.
Totally, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And once a student's kind of been through university or, you know, is looking beyond university, what kind of point of university is to have a good time, but it's also in theory to prepare you for working life. Do you think do you think this makes a difference and you find these individuals are more ready or more, you know, kind of, yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I can just add in, like, in terms of like hard statistics, like Canada wide, the unemployment rate for folks with developmental and intellectual disabilities is roughly 80%.
Wow.
Which is a pretty staggering number, of course. We found with our support at Inclusive Post-Secondary Education, that number essentially flips on its head, and that 75% of students we work for may be finding paid employment opportunities. So that, you know, that doesn't answer the whole question, but that's a pretty significant statistic for sure. So one example, being an SFU employer, hiring a student in a unionized role for an on-campus job, this being a really good example of someone on campus creating an inclusive environment. Unionized roles are kind of classically quite specific in maybe what the job description is laid out to be. And a big part of our role in supporting employment often is taking maybe an existing job description and modifying it to sort of suit the specific what the student we're working for might specifically be bringing to the employer, which works really great. Works well for students and works well for employers. Gets a little bit tricky when a union is concerned about word for word what does the job description say. We kind of lucked out with this person at SFU who was really influential in the hiring process for this role, got our initiative right away, was on board, and the story basically ends there because she was able to push a few buttons, talk to the right people, and this student ended up holding a unionized role, that would have been really difficult to access without this person's support and kind of willingness to push forward. Mm-hmm. So that benefits that student right away, and also has sort of like created some precedents at SFU for future opportunities. We can say now that, you know, if any employers are hesitant because a role is unionized, we've got a roadmap to sort of to point to.
Very similar to, I guess, here on campus too, like working with key allies or key people who have that sort of influential role in pushing back that narrative of like, oh, people with disabilities can't work, or that sort of assumption. Even here on campus, we're working with a lot of different departments for either co-ops or like a paid opportunity, work learn. We currently work with the UBC Rec right now, who have been really great allies in advocating for inclusion in a workplace. I think it's really important to have paid opportunities, obviously, but like demonstrating that it is possible. And like, we actually have an alumni here. There was a student who studied here maybe like many years ago, 10 years ago or something like that. And now she works on campus as a UBC staff. So something like that, I think, is really, really great to mention for students that we work for, students that we don't work for, or employers, just to recognize that, these are very possible opportunities. So
I imagine each time you manage something new, it's like, okay, well, we've done it now. Mm-hmm. It can be done again. And like, mm-hmm. like you say, you know, if someone has that concern, you can point back to it and say, actually, mm-hmm. we know how to, not only is it possible, but here is how we did it.
Yeah.
And let's do it again.
People don't always want to be the first to do something, but are happy to be the second, third, or fourth, right?
Yeah.
And that has been something that's worked really well, especially in the university sort of ecosystem. Like, if I work at SFU, maybe if folks know that something kind of happened at UBC that was really impactful for students, that's really helpful for someone at SFU to be like, oh, okay, like we can do this. Same goes with UVic. Lots of schools sort of like kind of bounce off each other like that. And that, like you were saying, kind of goes with our focus when we're supporting students is like, how can this university experience set the table for a lifelong of inclusion in the wider community?
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, like anyone else in university, they're making connections with their peers and maybe professors or TAs, professional and social connections. That's definitely a big emphasis of ours that we try to support students for.
Mm-hmm.
Our support, sadly, basically comes to an end not long after a student graduates. So if a student finishes in the spring, we would continue support for the following summer, maybe hopefully
August.
Until August, roughly. Hopefully, if the student is not already employed, maybe trying to set the table for an employment opportunity. Working with the student and their families, oftentimes families are a huge part of anyone's life. Oftentimes more so for folks with developmental and intellectual disabilities. That sort of family reliance is often bigger, and it. This all sounds really positive, and it is. And then there's certainly a question mark and a variance of like what kind of support exists for folks after. There are support opportunities. There are funding ways for folks to get support. Oftentimes, we try to support a student and or their family maybe in setting up a subsequent support that sort of feels like it might be kind of in line with what the student's been working towards.
Mm-hmm.
After university, but that's an area that we would love to have more certainty mm-hmm. on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just echoing what Ben was saying, a lot of conversations with families, peers, instructors, even just discussing about what lifelong inclusion looks like.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean, you know, just because you study 4 to 5 years. Inclusion doesn't stop right when you graduate, right? And like finding these communities and employers that value the same sort of goals that the student has, and obviously our our views of what inclusion looks like and what it should look like. So, yeah.
Have you guys, I mean, like, Ellie, it's been not very long since you graduated at all. A lot of you guys, you know, relatively recently out of university. But now being back on campus, do you notice a change since you were there?
I think UBC has been shifting for, like, the past 5 or so years to become more accessible. There's still room, but I think there has been a shift for the past 5 years, really, and making progress.
Yeah, I was going to say, even for me, like, I'm not from Vancouver or BC, mm-hmm. and so when I went to school in Alberta, I didn't even know this sort of thing existed, like inclusive post-secondary education. And then when I actually started working here, they were like, oh, this movement actually stems from Inclusion Alberta. And so that was like a really like big surprise to me, because a lot of the work that was happening behind the scenes, or I guess like students that I would see on when I went to school and university, were supported, obviously, but you wouldn't really see those sort of support workers with them or facilitators. A lot of it was behind the scenes, and you don't really realize it until, I guess, you're in this type of work. And when we do talk about inclusion and what that should look like and how does that look like on campus. So I do think it's, yeah, slowly shifting, but there's still like a lot of work that needs to be done and a lot of conversations that need to be like held. Even on campus, like with UBC, it's such a huge campus that like all these conversations that we have when approaching departments or instructors, sometimes they're not really aware that we've been in partnership with the university for over 20 years. So, yeah, it's very ongoing.
And it's not a guarantee, just like to sort of add.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
We talk a lot about safeguarding our initiative at the various campus partnerships we have and do a lot of work and thought towards that. I think that over the last, yeah, maybe 5 years or so, it feels like, you know, inclusion, the word inclusion has definitely like come up and is really in vogue sort of thing, right? Which is great to see. And I think a lot of institutions, not just universities, are really embracing that. But with that also comes a whole array of what even is the definition of inclusion, mm-hmm. what is quote unquote real inclusion. And then outside of that too, I think we would all say that there are other forces sort of maybe in the culture that are very much non-embracing that word inclusion, or if it's part of EDI or DEI, that mm-hmm. has become
just elaborate on those acronyms so people don't know them?
Yeah, EDI being equity, diversity, and inclusion, and I think DEI being diversity, equity, and inclusion. So it depends on, I don't know who calls what which, but that, I mean, we've seen recently in the United States, very specific language directed sort of fired against DEI initiatives. This sort of shift to meritocracy, at least on the surface level, is the explanation for that. But I think that there's some deeper things going on there too. And I don't think Canada is immune to that. And it's definitely something that is like exists in the culture. And I think is sort of creeping in all kinds of spaces.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a couple of times about sort of inclusion and what inclusion actually is, and what's, I don't know, maybe healthy inclusion versus sort of surface level inclusion. For people who are like have been listening to this conversation, have no idea about any of this, or you know, haven't really happened to meet people with these kind of access needs, what can people be doing to maybe start thinking about this, maybe change their mindset, maybe be more active, you know, in a very literal sense? Are there some resources people can be looking at? What's the kind of, how do we start changing our mindsets?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can say, like, we are trying, like, there's a lot of stuff that I think each campus that we're partnered up with, each facilitator is working on. I know, like, for us, we're working, like, at UBC, we're working on a few different things. We're always open to hosting workshops, or we actually did one recently with CITR and the Center of Community Engaged Learning here at UBC for a workshop called Access for All. And yeah, we're always open to coming in, discussing about inclusion, inclusive post-secondary education as well. What can we do to further inclusion on campus? Yeah, there's a lot of different conversations that are happening across, I guess, the province. Yeah.
What are some good, like, sources for resources and that kind of thing? Like, are there books you guys would recommend as on a, you know, on a personal recommendation, or like, where, if I wanted to do some more reading about this kind of thing, where might I go to find this stuff?
Definitely our website, honestly, mm-hmm. is really extensive. I think the website is bc-ipse.org.
Okie dokie. We'll have it at the stations on this. So if people want to check, you can always come down to CITR and we'll point you towards the website and that kind of stuff.
The website has a really quite a lot of information about who we are, and then sort of like, it's funny, the it's like under the tab guideline for facilitators, so actually that would be for us in our role. I think it's interesting that that's like publicly available, because it details a lot of sort of the historical context of why this initiative exists and the work we do, details different benchmarks for inclusion. So there's this sort of like hard, like, here's a list of what we would maybe want to look for what's happening at any given campus and what's happening for a student. So there's a lot of information there, and a bunch of other good stuff there too.
Mm-hmm. And for young people who might be listening, who might be, you know, a beneficial recipient of getting involved with Steps Forward, if they're, you know, looking at post-secondary education now, what's the process for them to kind of get involved and get, you know, get some feedback from you guys and get stuck in with Steps Forward?
Yeah, there is so we often go to transition fairs for that are put on by different high school districts, so whether in the lower mainland or elsewhere. Those fairs are specifically made available for students, teachers, families, et cetera, but that's specifically sort of different services available to folks with developmental and intellectual disabilities. So we often show up there with mm-hmm. information and just a good opportunity to meet prospective students and families. Also, again, directing to the website, there's a really great advocacy guide for families thinking about how can they advocate for their child to be included meaningfully in their primary and secondary school experience and community, their wider community. There's a lot of good information there for sure. Mm-hmm.
Obviously, when we talk about university students, generally we imagine 18 to 22. Like, is there a space for adults with, you know, the same sorts of developmental disabilities? Do you have many people getting involved with Steps Forward who are slightly older and maybe 10 years ago thought, well, university isn't for me, I can't do that, and now 10 years later have come across you guys and it's like, well, actually, maybe there is a route forward?
Yeah, if you would like to attend inclusive post-secondary any institutes, you would, I guess, just be another mature student on campus. There's not really an age limit. I think as long as you demonstrate like the passion and interest of studying a certain subject or program on the campus, then yeah, we just kind of get to know them.
Yeah, and we do notice that a little bit, because a lot of the students went to different universities and colleges before as well, so some of them are
like they like tried it and it wasn't quite working out and they like stepped away from it. Is that what you mean? Or
I'm not really sure.
Could have been like there are a lot of colleges and universities do vocational programs or what are called adult education programs. That is definitely a common experience for students who end up kind of studying through inclusive post-secondary. Those programs definitely vary, but that would be maybe more that sort of segregated experience. So they're happening at universities, but they're very specifically like for folks with disabilities to be in and around a space that's for folks with disabilities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you guys have offices on campuses? Can you be like reached in person,
we're always on campus, but we don't have like a designated office.
Yeah. It's easier to, yeah. At UBC especially, it's easier to kind of text, or I mean not text, but give us a call or email us. We always work on campus, but yeah, unfortunately we don't have an office space.
So where do people find that contact information? Is that on the website as well, or is that individual university websites?
Yeah, for UBC, I know we have, UBC has posted our information, but I think for all of us, I can't really speak on SFU or UVic if they have any information on their specific website, but yeah, for any of our information, I think it would be really great to find it on our individual website. So
there was one thing that I wanted to add about the information on the website. I think that it's really cool that we have that guide for facilitators available to everybody on the website, because it really speaks to, like, maybe you're not working as an inclusion facilitator, but having the tools to facilitate inclusion it's a skill to have. It's not something that you have to be working in this role to do. And I think that accessing the website and taking a look at that guide for facilitators is a good way that people who want to be that natural support on campus can really start there and start getting an idea of like what they can be doing and the language that they can be using and bringing other people in.
I suppose, and obviously not to put words into your mouth, so please feel free to disagree if this is inaccurate, but I suppose in some senses the ultimate goal of programs like Steps Forward, not programs, of organizations, is that a
initiative?
Yeah. Initiatives like Steps Forward is that long term we all sort of become facilitators, right? And everyone is able to just understand how to, you know, approach someone who has different access needs.
That is totally spot
on. Yeah, totally.
Like, you could all hear
long
our
story short. Yeah, that's basically what we're trying to go for.
If we, like, we do talk about that too, like, what, like, the question, like, what would happen if we didn't exist, like, tomorrow as an initiative, as a partnership on campus? Like, what would happen for the students that we're currently supporting? Like, would it continue on? And, you know, that's a mixed bag. But what's comforting with that question is when we can think of all kinds of different campus allies that we have. The university is, like, committed to this work. And, like, we could feel comfortable that, like, yeah, if we did disappear tomorrow, the university would feel like they want to take it on their own. Mm-hmm. Maybe the student body in different ways would feel like this is valuable.
We hope you enjoyed this conversation with some of the team from Steps Forward. If you want to learn any more about what the initiative does, then you can visit their website, www.bc-ipse.org. That's www.bc-ipse.org.
Is the simple joy of riding a bike missing from your life? No worries. Ride On Bike Shop has got you covered. Ride On has the best deals in town for new and used bikes, top-notch servicing, and all the parts or accessories you've been dreaming about. Whether you've got a little one who needs to learn how to ride, or if you're about to go on the Tour de France, Ride On is the place for you. We'll also happily pick up your old bikes and recycle them back into the community. Located on 2255 West Broadway, we are open from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. from Tuesday to Saturday. That's RIDEON Bike Shop. See you there!
We are UBC Electronica, and we love electronic music sessions. Run for them life when I step into the jungle. We offer DJ workshops, open decks, pop-up parties, and more. Follow our socials such as Instagram, Discord, or join us through email, ubcelectronica@gmail.com.
We're bombarded by misinformation from every direction. It's hard to know who to trust, but you can trust the voices you hear on this station and other community campus and Indigenous broadcasters across the country.